Okay, so we are beginning Crazy Love, Class 4. My numbers are off. And we are in Chapter 2. We had an introduction. We did Chapter 1 for a little bit, talked about the idea of talking, who are you talking to when you're talking to God. Chapter 2 is entitled, You May Not Finish This Chapter, which means basically the idea of life being fleeting and short and being a vapor or a mist is one of those things that we have to tackle when we live in this world. Last class, we had some folks that were here that talking about that kind of concept is much more difficult, especially in recent days and months. And so I don't want to belabor the point here, but he moves on from the idea of life is fleeting, life is transient, we're moving through this world quickly, as it seems. And he moves on to the idea that he had a heart condition, which I told my little spiel about my non-life-threatening but semi-scary heart condition I got when I got here, and fully convinced it was because of stress that had accumulated over a good little while. Got a small arrhythmia going on, and that made my heart kind of freak out for a bit. It wasn't caffeine. As I grab my coffee and sip 6 shots of espresso, because, you know, here we are, early in the morning. What's that?
Bad for your heart.
That's not what I read.
Drink some big caffeine.
No, caffeine's good for you. I'm not sure about 6 shots of espresso in one sitting, but I mean, there are studies that say, you know, it helps prevent Alzheimer's and heart disease, and so here we are. These old timers that are sipping down cups and cups of coffee all day long. I mean, you know, it's like a workout, they say. I mean, does not take the place of exercise. Thank you, Nancy. Medical opinion.
I don't know, you get a lot of exercise when you drink a lot of cups. You have to lift your arm.
Got a good arm workout. That's true. If you put sugar or cream in there, I mean, instantly, just check out early. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Okay, Mom, you didn't hear my comment. Here's my comment. Did you read Chapter 3 like I asked you to? Just Chapter 2? That's okay. We're going to move into Chapter 3, and Chapter 3 is pretty self-explanatory. It's called Crazy Love. Seems like a good name for a book, if you ask me. Okay, the idea about his heart condition interrupting here, basically from stress. He prayed it away. I mean, again, I would seek a medical professional first and then pray it away. Probably a good idea if it's a biological problem to get seen by someone who knows biology. It seems pretty convenient. It's at least going to limit how much you worry about it. So here you have an underlying quote. Worry implies that we don't quite trust God that God is big enough, powerful enough, or loving enough to take care of what's happening in our lives. Again, that's kind of a broad stroke. I mean, do we have anxiety and worry in our lives? Sometimes. If you don't, see me afterwards and tell me your secret. I mean, sometimes stuff happens, and if you're not worried about something, maybe things have been going great for you. I didn't worry when I was younger, and then as I got more responsibility, and then things kind of pile up, and then you have folks that you care about that you want to be there for, uncertainty can creep in, right? Mother read Chapter 3, so you know what we're going to be talking about, Mom. I hope you like being an illustration. Okay. Worry... It does that stress says that the things we are involved in are important enough to merit our impatience, our lack of grace towards others, or our tight grip of control. Let's pause there. The quote goes on, obviously, but that's one thing that he's trying to emphasize is when you are stressed out, you act as if you are someone who is stressed out. I've never been guilty of doing something rashly or maybe raising my voice or acting in a rude way because I'm stressed out. I'm thankful for that. As everyone who looks at me tongue-in-cheek knows, I'm being facetious, yeah. And when you get stressed out, you act in an impatient way. Just this week, I'm going to go to the confession booth now. Just this week, I was sitting in a situation where I had some individuals that were not looking up when they were waiting for a light to turn downtown. I was trying to go through the crosstown, and they were not doing that. Whatever they were doing on their phone was much more important than me trying to get from point A to point B. And so I had to sit through a light at Line Street, essentially, 3 turns through the crosstown. It wasn't rush hour, so it wasn't an hour of me waiting there, but by the second person who wouldn't look up when my horn was pressed to kind of remind them that they're in a car, I was getting a little antsy, let's say, and my dash cam might have recorded me saying, "Come on," after the third person. So, I mean, stress does that to you, right? And that's what he's trying to say here, is if we are living in a state of constant stress and worry, and yet we're trying to live as people that follow Jesus, we might have a problem there with our own way of thinking, mindset, and probably most importantly when it comes to our influence, people are looking at us. And if they know that we are people that espouse to be followers of God, and we behave just like them or worse when something stressful happens, it's not going to be a great appeal for someone to kind of say, "Oh, well, tell me more about this God that you serve," right? So that's kind of what he's trying to get at. Let's read the next quote. Basically, these two behaviors communicate that it's okay to sin and not trust God because the stuff in my life is somehow exceptional, right? It applies to everybody else but me because my life's really, really important. Both worry and stress reek of arrogance. They declare our tendency to forget that we've been forgiven, that our lives here are brief, and that we are headed to a place where we won't be lonely, afraid, or hurt ever again, and that in the context of God's strength, our problems are small indeed. And so, again, we're just traveling through this land, right? And while we're here, things seem really, really important, and they seem profound, and they seem difficult, and they seem impossible. And yet, if we really understand the God of the Scriptures, then we need to know that that's okay, because God is still in control no matter what happens to us. Again, easy to say, hard to live out. And I know that's the case for a lot of us in our congregation. It's easy to say, yep, God's in control. But when you lose someone you love, that's when it really becomes a thing we need to remind ourselves. I mentioned, I'm pretty sure, if not, I should have, the book of Job, the oldest book we have in our Scriptures. He's a patriarch, did a great job. He was someone who God relied on, trusted in, knew his heart, and was tempted by Satan to have those things that God gave him removed to see how he would react. And he reacted well, all things considered. Lost basically everyone in his life. I mean, at least if not physically, then definitely emotionally. We mentioned his wife said, "Curse God and die." I mean, it's hard to have a helpmeet that does that to you. And yet, in the same concept, at the very end of the book, God is essentially trying to teach him the lesson of, you know, you weren't around when I made the world the way it is, when I put the stars the way they are, I made these animals that are just fearsome. You weren't there. I didn't need to consult you for any of that. So your life, I got it. Trust me. That was the overall message said in a very poetic way, but definitely that was the intention. So when it comes to us, very practically, it's easy to know this stuff theoretically. The point is to talk about this enough that when something happens that causes you to stress or to worry, you're kind of jarred into, okay, I know how I want to react, but here is me take a breath, step back, and kind of think about those things we talked about back then, right? Any thoughts, comments along those lines before we move forward? Matthew.
It's very ironic. Last night I was presented with more stress than I've had in almost my entire life. I was confronted with an individual who did a home invasion into my house, and I had the chance to do something very violent against them last night, and because I'm a child of God and I'm a Christian, I let it rot and let them go. And that was a very big test for me last night.
Okay.
And I was glad that he gave me the strength to be able to get through that, because I didn't lower myself to this level, and it was a test by God to see what I would do.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you didn't kill anybody. That's good.
I wanted to.
Well, you know, somebody breaks into my house, hurts my family, or intends to, that's a real deal.
Well,
Appreciate the insight there. That's definitely, I mean, that's impossible to deal with.
He gave you the strength to do it.
There you go. All right, the next little line here, why are we so quick to forget God? Who do we think we are? And that's just the way Francis Chan writes. It's the way he talks, actually. This is probably dictated, to be honest. And the way he's thinking about this, again, broad strokes from him. He's not really one for detail. If you've noticed that so far, he makes a lot of broad strokes when it comes to these things. Stress is this. Yeah, for that intent, obviously, is what he's trying to get to. He's trying to be succinct here in what he has to say. I'll diverge later. Not yet. Okay. Anything else from anybody else? Go ahead, Gary.
In my own life, I had a lot more worry and stress when I was making decisions that were contrary to God's word. But when I repented and became a Christian, my life became a lot easier because I made a lot better decisions in my life. So I'm really a pretty worried, stress-free guy. Only because of my decisions, my better decisions, I look at the word of God before I try to make decisions and it directs my life.
Right. It's much more difficult to direct your own steps because everything is dependent on you, and you know how weak you are, right? I distinctly remember this thought going through my brain when I was a kid, and I was trying to figure out the meaning of life and what to do and all this kind of stuff, and now I'm just like, when I finally became a Christian, and I was just like, well, I've made decisions for the past how many ever number of years, and I don't think it's going that well. So I can't do this very well, so I'm just going to give it up. And if I'll just do what this guy says to do from this book, maybe that will help me. And then, of course, obviously, the more I mature, the more I look back at that mindset of, I'm not doing that great. Maybe it's time for somebody else to take the reins. That's kind of that's the same thing basically you're saying, but in different words. He's an illustration here I'm not a huge fan of. I'm not a huge fan of everything he has to say, obviously. I don't like this idea of him minimizing self here in this chapter to the idea of saying, well, the movie's not about you. I don't know if that's pride or what, but he says, well, the movie's about God. I'm like, okay, theologically, look at the word of God. We're not really in it except for the last couple of seconds, right? The story's already written. The plan's already there. We're coming in the tail end, we would say, timeline-wise, to this whole thing, and we get to learn the benefits of all these people that lived before us and their examples and so on. That's great. So why are you so self-consumed, I guess is his point, and that's fair enough. You don't want to be self-consumed if we're talking about God after all, but at the same time, there's a healthy balance here. My fear, my danger for myself is if you self-minimize too much, then I'm pointless, I'm meaningless, I have no value, no worth, and that's kind of I'm prone to that anyway. And so just one more guy saying, it's not about you, you don't matter, get over yourself, that to me is not helpful. For somebody else who's got maybe an ego problem, not me, then that might be a good kind of kick. But I don't have a big enough ego from anybody, especially from myself. And so being told you don't matter in this kind of way is not fine all cylinders for me. Eric? Go ahead.
What I think it does is it minimizes the idea that we were all made in the image of God and that he has a plan for each and every one of us. It seems to be in contrast with what he wrote later about how he knew each one of us before we were born and had all that set out for us.
Yeah. I've got a personal peeve with Chan about one thing, and it's along the same lines of what you just said. I'm not picking on you. Don't get me wrong. When God talks to Jeremiah and says, before you were in your mother's womb, I had a plan laid out for you. Paul talks about it in his books as well, the idea before my mother made me in my womb, I had this and so on. That's so specific to Jeremiah, for example. To me, that does not seem to imply to every single individual that that's what it is. So for me, it's a stretch to say, well, God said to Jeremiah, therefore it's true of me. I know God knows what my plan is. I have a role to play in the big scheme of things. God knew who I was before I was a person. I get that. But to use that quote from Jeremiah to say, therefore, here's how important I am, I have a hard time with that jump, personally. It's probably theologically right. God knows us, a plan for us, knows who we're going to be. I get all that, but everyone keeps going back to Jeremiah recently in my own reading as well. And it just seems, I don't know. He kind of hits that hard in this chapter and the next one that, well, you know, he was kind of lost until he read Jeremiah, had this role to play. Therefore, Chan has a role to play. I don't know. It bothers me a little bit. Does that make any sense at all? Tommy?
Jesus said he knows every hair that's in our head.
Yeah.
Ecclesiastes says that the whole beauty of purpose remains before you're done. So that is our plan.
Yeah.
As far as, I mean, it might not be specifically getting in the chariot and going to take care of a battle or Chaldeans or whatever, but there's still a plan there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. There's definitely a plan. God knows. There's all that.
Like you say, if he's saying that it applies to one of five, Jeremiah applies to others.
Yeah.
That can't be
true
to the degree that Jeremiah carried out what he was supposed to do.
That's kind of what I mean. Yeah, you're saying it better. Is he's looking at Jeremiah's life, which, I mean, if you know Jeremiah's life, pretty insane stuff. I mean, to say the least. He needed that little pep talk from God and says, look, you think of yourself as a youth right now, so you can't do what I'm telling you to do. I know what you're all about. I made you for this. You're the right person for the right job. But that was Jeremiah. I see how it's true of Moses. I see how it's true of important biblical character people along the way. I see how it's true of us. But to kind of elevate, I don't know, maybe it's the ego thing again, but just to elevate, say, oh, well, I'm as important as Jeremiah, surely. So here is why God chose me. Nah. I kind of get that feeling from this. Maybe it's not what he intended, obviously, but that's kind of what I get. So here's the fun one. Frankly, you need to get over yourself. As I smile into the camera, just get over it. People with depression being told to get over it, not the key. Just throwing that out there. I know we've all learned. I know we've all moved beyond that, but just, you know, in case you got someone or yourself, you're dealing with it and you've been told to get over it, that's not how that stuff works. So anyway, that's not what he's talking about here. He's saying the brevity of life and how important you think you are in comparison to God is nothing. I get that. That's the kind of key. But that's how that's the baggage I'm bringing to this chapter, as I say way too many times. Okay. Everybody good in my therapy session so far? Good? Okay. The point of your life is to point to him. Absolutely true. Whatever you are doing, God wants to be glorified because this whole thing is his. Yes. Okay. So that's the servant or slave mentality here. It's the idea of your master is over you. We all have a master, whether we want to kind of say we don't or not. Folks that are living the world, that live in sin, they have a master too. They don't recognize him as such most of the time. Some even glorify in the fact that they think they're serving Satan, ironically. But in this particular thing, he's saying, look, we're all subservient. We never asked to be here. We didn't plan this world. We find ourselves in this life, and we're serving, whether we want to or not. And so now that you have the choice of being free from sin to serve God, that's the one you want. That's the one that made you. So you're going back home is kind of the whole point and key. Jim?
There's so much of what you're saying here in the book of Philippians, which I'm studying for Bible Bowl.
Okay.
It may be in a different word, but it's all about every knee should bow in the name of Christ and putting him first in our lives. And also, in the second chapter, how to treat others.
Yeah.
Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or strife, but in lowliness of mind, esteem others better than ourselves.
Okay. I'm going to give you a warning for quoting the verse, but okay. But no, that's a joke. That's a thing from Bible Bowl. If you quote the verse too much, they give you a warning, so that's what that is, if you don't know.
Keep on warning me.
Okay. Is it Philippians 3? Let this mind be in you. Is that 2 or 3?
That's 2.
That's 2? Verse 1 and following?
Verse 5.
Verse 5? About the same. You know. It's not my book. No excuse.
Let this mind be in you.
Who's also in Christ Jesus, right? The idea of him emptying himself literally in the Greek and then becoming in the form or the image or the imprint of a slave. If God can empty himself and become a slave or servant of all mankind as our example, Seems kind of like what we should do too if we want to follow Jesus, right? If he did it, we should too.
Hardest lesson for me to even get over or learn is humbling myself in the sight of the Lord. I was stiff-necked. We talk about the Old Testament. That was Bill Ragland in the beginning. And I couldn't hardly even imagine myself humbling myself in the sight of anybody. But when you continue to study the scriptures, and the implication is get over yourself, because it's not that God doesn't think you matter. You matter to him. He loves all of us. Otherwise, he wouldn't have opened salvation to everyone through Jesus Christ. It's up to us to choose to be saved. And I don't know, this last thing that you read there, that brings it home for me.
Okay. There's the balance, right? Well, I'll say this thing and we'll move forward. There's the balance between people that say, well, you know, I don't want to submit myself to God and I don't deserve it or whatever on one hand. And then you have the other folks that say, well, I'm not worth anything. God can never forgive me. I'm not worth anything. And then, so you've got passages that underscore how we're not saved by works that we have done. We're saved by his grace and faith. That's for the first hand. And the second hand is we are the righteousness of God in Christ or in him. So no, we do have value. He died for us. We are worth it. He sacrificed for us. And so there's that balance of no matter where you kind of are on that scale, there's a thought for you to kind of take home. Okay, thank God we are weak. All of a sudden, our little girls wanted to carry their new baby brother around. My wife and I constantly told them to be careful because he's fragile. It got me wondering when he would no longer be fragile. When he's 2, 8, junior high, college, married, once he had kids. As someone whose 3-year-old daughter really wants to do what we do with Luke, we have to be mindful what we do to Luke in front of her. She's going to mimic picking him up and trying to show him how to use those chubby little legs. She wants to do that too. And when she does, she puts him down before his hands are out and smashes his nose into the floor. Just saying, that could be a thing that happens once or twice. So is he fragile? Yeah, he's kind of squishy right now, you know. He's got some padding, though.
He'll stop being fragile the day when you're not around anymore. That's the when you'll stop being fragile.
Stop being fragile when you're not around anymore.
When you yourself are not around.
To watch world, the damage being done?
No.
Oh.
This world.
Oh.
That's when they'll stop being fragile.
Well,
we're always your babies.
You'll always worry.
I don't worry. What are you talking about? Be anxious for nothing. But in prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. Y'all, I don't worry.
I see that prayer and supplication when you come home, come back from your sermon, and she's coming down the stairs. I see that happening right then.
Hey, listen, you don't know me. Okay, moving on. Life is fragile. It's not under control. Oh, geez. Uh-oh. Paragraph from my mother. My connection keeps buffering today. Okay, not important. I'm lagging behind. Try to stay connected. Okay, well, Mom, it'll be uploaded later. I was waiting for some profound, like, Alan, here's what you did when you were 5. If life were stable, I'd never need God's help. Since it's not, I reach out for him regularly. I am thankful for the unknowns. I don't have control because it makes me run to God. I mean, that was kind of the whole big deal about the minor and major prophets, right? You have a nation here who's running away from God as fast as they can. The prophets are trying to say, listen, you know that famine we had last year where we almost died? Yeah, that was God saying, wake up. Remember the Chaldeans that came across the field, the Babylonians that are coming, the Assyrians that were already here and destroyed half our nation? That's God trying to say, wake up. And so sometimes things happen to us that make us wake up. And that's kind of why at funerals we have the person who goes up there and talks. They usually end it with, hey, look, this is kind of one of those moments where we come to the house of mourning and we learn how to move through this. It's hard, it's difficult, but at the same time, these are the moments that kind of shake us out of our day-to-day worries, right? So that's kind of important to mention. There's a story here about an individual named Stan Gerlich, and he was a businessman who's known in his community. The whole point is he gave a message about you need to be ready, and then he died. I mean, it's pretty dramatic. The idea of you never know when you're going to be the one to go next, that's a real conversation. If it hasn't happened to you yet, it might soon. And so just be aware that this life truly is fragile, right? It's short. We never know what's going to happen next. We want that security of knowing what is going to happen tomorrow and next week and next month, and we want that security of knowing it, but that sometimes is an illusion, right? There's the parable of the man who did really, really well for himself. He had so many crops laid up, he had to tear down this barn and build a brand new one to store all the things he had prepared for the future. And what did Jesus say? You're a fool. Well, that's pretty harsh language. Didn't he say, call no man fool? Matthew chapter 5, by the way. Why is he called a fool there? Because that night his soul was required of him. The implication being his soul wasn't ready. Like, he had laid up for himself all these physical things, but he hadn't laid nothing up in a spiritual sense. And that's what was important then. Not the next year's crops. He was ready to go then. And that was the plan. So, of course, the key is that balance once again. Yes, plan, prepare wisely for the future, and then at the same time, be ready to go right now. Okay, questions? There's a story here about Brooke, 14-year-old girl who was a follower of Christ. She spent her babysitting money on Bibles to give them out to her unsaved friends at school, and then she died in a car accident, right? And so the people that saw her as a 14-year-old child and heard her talking about Jesus, that made an impact because her life was so short. My senior year in high school, 6 people died. We had 3 suicides and 3 from car accidents. So that kind of makes you wake up, you know. You got people that you're going to school with and that, you know, they're dating people and they're going, one guy got a full ride scholarship to Virginia Tech, junior. And his girlfriend, Emma, broke up with him after 4 years of dating, right before college started. So he went home and got a belt and took his own life. And so it's a reality, right? That when you're a kid getting ready to go to college or going ready to graduate, that's all that you're thinking about. So, and you got 6 people that you went to high school with, not there for graduation because they drove in a Jeep that was, when they were drunk, and they rolled it and they were all crushed. That wakes you up. And you got 3 other people that, one maybe was murdered, but then the rest took their lives. That kind of says, okay, this is not a joke. We're not guaranteed tomorrow. So, there was a girl, Heather, that I was friends with in high school, and she was nice to me, which says a whole lot. Before I was a Christian, she was nice to me, which, again, I don't know how or why, but she was, and she was one of the few. And she OD'd. You know, don't know if it was accidental or not, but it looked pretty close to suicide. So that was difficult, to say the least. So we've all lost people, right? That's the idea of what he's trying to say here is we like the security of day-to-day. We love the idea that we are in control and that we can control everything. As a control freak, I get that. I understand what that feels like, but it's an illusion, right? It's not real because life is uncertain. Life can be short, and need to be aware of it. Okay, questions, comments? Didn't mean to go that heavy with you, but there it is. Ecclesiastes, it's better to go to the house of mourning and weeping, right? Why? Because that's where life hits. You go to a funeral, it kind of wakes you up to what's going on. My first date with Melissa was a funeral for one of our friends. Sounds bad, I know, but, you know, He was killed. He died at the very least. And I saw him in the hallways. I knew him. And then she was good friends with him. So going to a funeral, that wakes you up. That says, look, by the way, babe, I want to be a preacher. It's part of the deal. So, okay, chapter 3. Does Jesus love you?
Absolutely.
As a loving father loves his child. Okay, so I got a lot of yes from the first one, and then nothing from the second one. More? More than a father loves his child. If it's possible, well, it's possible. It's possible, apparently.
Alan, you've been talking about Bible Bowl. So
last night, first I'm hearing about it.
Ephesians 5, and it talks about wives, and you know that submit word seems to be such a negative connotation, but wives were just and husbands loving. And the comparison is how Christ loved the church,
mm-hmm.
and as Christ loved the church, that he gave his life for the church. So. Ask that question again.
Okay. Does God love us like a loving father loves his child?
If that loving father is willing to die for his child.
Side note. I don't know why I keep thinking about this thought, but someone said it to me once and it kind of made sense. We have husbands here. If you do, would you raise your hand just a little bit? A couple husbands. Do you love your wives as much as Christ loved the church? Would you be willing to lay down your life to save your wife's life?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Couple of yes?
Yes.
Sounds good. Would you be willing to wash dishes because you love your wife? No. So the illustration I heard one time was, you really want to say, yeah, I'll die for her, but I won't let her have the TV remote or whatever. You know, it's kind of like, oh, I see where you're going with this. Like, yeah, I'll die for you, but I'll be dead. So then you can do whatever you want, but I'm not going to live for you. I mean, that's an interesting thought, but so obviously do what you will with that idea. What he does, I did not know this about Francis Chan before I read the book. The idea of his own family life, which I think is interesting. I mean, I assumed, I don't know why, that he grew up in the church or in a church, and he was taught the Bible, which he was from a young age. And he kind of went along with the program for a little while, not really buying in, but he did all the things he was supposed to do, he thought. And then later, he kind of was like, well, this is not real. It's not a reality to me. I need to change my attitude about this. But I just assumed he had a decent family life. Mom and dad took him to church. Not what happened. His mother died in childbirth with him. And so his father became an alcoholic. And he was extremely physically abusive. And if you're physically abusive, I mean, you can pretty much guarantee you're going to be emotionally abusive as well. It's hard to have that. You might have the pendulum swing, which is always fun, to never know who you're going to get. But the idea is, it was a difficult childhood for him. He had a stepmom who also died when he was 14. And so he's not someone who kind of grew up with, what's the family we always use?
Leave it to Beaver.
That's the one. He didn't have a Leave it to Beaver kind of lifestyle, right? It was in 1950. It was a little bit different. Were the 50s as good as people say they are? Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you lock your door at night?
Yeah. Told me all the time that I had that kind of life.
Well, your dad was a preacher. He had the best life there ever was.
Yeah. But then I...
Yeah. Then you what?
Then I wasn't.
Then you weren't. Okay. When the 60s came around, everything changed. Is that what I'm hearing?
Just
throwing it out there. I remember the only affection I got when I was 9 years old. This is Francis Chan. He put his arm around me for about 30 seconds while we were on our way to my stepmother's funeral. Besides that, the only other physical touch I experienced were the beatings I received when I disobeyed or bothered him. My goal, here we go, in our relationship was not to annoy my father. Anyone ever experienced something kind of like that with your own family? You can admit it or not, doesn't matter to me.
No, but my mother, she worked for Department of Social Services, and she would come home and tell me about a story. stories about kids getting taken, that she would take away from, you know, their broken homes and stuff, and that just gave me a reality check of how thankful I was to have my parents.
So my mom's buffering right now, so I can say whatever I want. She can't hear it. My mother never abused me. She was the greatest mother I ever could have asked for. She was patient. She was kind. She's loving. She's sacrificial. I really had it kick in when I had mine. And I was like, what did you do when I was either 3 weeks old, and Dad walked out. You were by yourself. You were down that income, obviously. I didn't save the marriage. Can you believe it? I mean, how great I am. I didn't save the marriage. Weird. Dad had checked out by then, by the way, if you didn't know already, emotionally. And so I was like, I can't imagine looking at this little girl being 3 weeks or even 3 months old and just going in there, packing my bags and walking away. And she said that he never even looked in the crib, just walked out. And I was like, I cannot fathom it. Nor can I fathom the idea of, well, now that I don't have anyone to bring in the income, I have to drop you off with a stranger and go back to work. And I've got to get the income to pay for this child. And I just can't. And then after a long day of work, you come home, you get a couple of hours before I go down to bed, and that's all you get. That's what my mother did. And so, yeah, my mother never abused me. She sacrificed for me. Did she smack me in the face a couple of times to wake me up from my knuckleheadedness? She sure did, because the spankings didn't work. She tells me that she tried to spank me one time, and I laughed and ran off. So then she's like, all right. And then a couple of smart aleck comments later got us, hit in the face. And then, I've told us before, so it's not that embarrassing. She, 12, 13, something like that. And I was acting out, and I deserved it. And she smacked me right in the face, and I was upset. And so here's my plan. I walked over to her and told her how it was going to be, because, you know, I'm man of the house now. It's a great line. Never tell your kids that, by the way. Walked over, called the man of the house, and I said, listen, I'm not going to call social services. That was my opening line. And she's like, uh-huh, go ahead, keep going, please. And I was like, next time you do that, I'm out of here. She's like, okay. She's like, it's not funny. She was like, okay, it's not funny. Go ahead and call them. Tell them, go ahead. I'm like, okay. My bargaining chip is gone. Why does she not want me to call? So I'm like, okay, I wasn't being abused. Got it. But anyway, that's kind of where I was at. That was fun. Okay. So my mom was great. Dad, not so much. He was gone for a bit. He has his own issues he's coming out of. I understand that now. But when you're a kid and that's the hero of your life, your father figure, that can leave you with an impression of what a father is or isn't. So when God says he's your father, that puts a hue on it. For me, what was God? Well, God says, I'm like your father. I'm like, well, all right, so let me get this straight. This is who God is. God, to me, is someone who's inconsistent in being present. He says he'll be there at 3 o'clock. He means really 5:30. That's how God is. God, to me, is someone that when you talk to him, if you choose to do so, you don't know who you're talking to. Either he's your best friend, or he's a father figure, and you better roll the dice on which one it is, because what you say really matters. If he's your best friend, you can tell him anything in the world, and he's going to give you some advice. If he wants to be your father figure right then and there, you're going to get punished arbitrarily, as if he has the right to do so. That's who God is to me. Who is God? God is someone who, when you even begin to speak to him, you have to gauge the temperature of the room to know if you are allowed to speak what's true in your heart. That's who God is. God is someone who, if he finds someone better than you, you are second class, even second class. He's someone that paid for your love by paying child support and buying you things when you got too mad at him. So he'll give you a blessing or two to appease you if you're really upset. That's who God is to me. As I grow and mature, and especially what he said here about having his own children and becoming a father, that changed the game for him, changed the game for me. Looking at those little babies with all their rolls and cheeks. I get it. When God says he's a loving father, he says, you know, if you, being evil, your sons ask you for bread, are you going to give them a serpent or a stone? No, you're going to give them things that they need because you love them. How much more so will your Father in heaven? Like, okay, now I get it. I love these little things more than I can ever express in words. And you can't tell someone what it's like unless they've been through it. But that's how Jesus was relating God to them. He was basically saying, I just came from God. And if you want to know how much he thinks about you, I'm here to pay for your sin. That's how much he loves you. That's how much I love you, he's saying. Now I get it. Now I'm getting it. The reason why I wanted to focus on this a little bit and be a bit more personal was because when we talk to people about God and we mention the idea of our Father in heaven, if you haven't gone through that experience of looking at God through your dad's lenses, be aware of it at the very least. Because with some people, that's going to discourage them more than encourage them. My mother never knew who her father was, never had any relationship at all with him, never knew his name. And so when she would tell me later that she thought of God as her father, the only one that she needed, there's no comparing those situations at all. But she has a blank canvas in some regards. The pain's still there, don't get me wrong. A blank canvas for God, well, I've got... My canvas is pretty full, but it's all black. So I got to chop through all that first. And so it's kind of, we bring different things to the table here, and that's part of the brokenness of the world. It's not the way God designed it, obviously. If it was done the way God originally designed it for the family to function the way that it should without sin, we wouldn't have this conversation. But the world is broken, and that's why we need the love of our Father in heaven to show us what it's supposed to be, and then aim towards that in the next cycle, if we will, the next generation. Okay, questions, comments? If you guys want to share anything about this, feel free.
This past Wednesday, this is going to sound like I'm bragging, but I'm not. Whenever I was going to get something to eat, there was a woman who was struggling with a buggy, and she was going to return something to Steinmart. She had on top of the buggy. She couldn't get the buggy up on the curb. And I called out to her. She was way ahead. I said, ma'am, just wait. I'll help you. So when I got up there, then she goes, okay, I'm good. Thank you. And then I held the door because she couldn't open that. And she goes, your mother raised the gentleman. And I know what she was trying to do was compliment me.
Yeah.
But in the same respect, I felt like she was taking a slap at my dad. Because, and I understand, I can't understand, but I hear what you're saying. But there's so many times, those of us who have had a great example, it seems like those examples are discounted because there are, we don't talk enough about that. Paul says in our material that we're studying, look at those men. He's talking about following the gospel, living the way that they should. Look at those examples, and I think. That's one of the things that's difficult for us to do. And I said to the woman, you're right, she did, but my father did too.
Yeah.
And I don't know that she didn't mean it to be that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, whenever there are those people in our lives, whether or not they're our fathers or uncles or friends or whatever, we need to build those men up as well. And women, obviously.
Yeah. It's interesting. I never would have thought that's how you would have felt about it. With someone saying that.
I'm just saying
from my own personal, like, yeah, of course you did. But your father was there. And for me, that concept kind of hit, like, oh, yeah, you had a dad. Like, okay, yeah.
And
whoops.
You know, you asked the question, would you wash the dishes for your... He did. So that's
yeah.
The natural thing for me to do is to wash dishes now. I don't think anything
yeah.
about that.
Well, it's a great blessing to have two parents that love each other. And they give you that example. I mean, that's not to sound, you know, I had a great mom, you know. I had a great mom. No discount to her whatsoever. I did not have the roughest of childhoods. I mean, looking back, there were some fun moments and some things that were not so great, but it was fine. I had food on the table. I had a loving grandmother who's still kicking somehow. So things were going great. But to have the example of a family working basically the way that God wanted it to is such a great benefit. And so I look at our family, for example, and we have a mother, we have a father, and we have two kids, and we're doing the right things, hopefully, and we're giving them good examples, and so we're breaking that cycle and trying to paint a better picture as to what the family is in God's mind. And that's going to be, who knows, what a blessing to them in the future. So, okay, we're out of time. We will pick this up next week. The end of this chapter basically is the idea of him being afraid of God from pretty obvious reasons of him being afraid of his father to the idea of branching out through grace to understand what it means to not just be loved by God, but to love him back. And that's a step that's hard to communicate, but it's easy to experience. And so we'll talk more about that next time, and then we'll go on to chapter 4. I want to give you a preface real quick. You can read chapter 4. Feel free. Chapter 4 is where things get a little bit stepping on toes, right? It's a profile of someone who is lukewarm. And again, remember he paints with broad strokes here. Pretty broad. So don't think he's picking too hard on the church or our church or any church. He's just kind of saying this is kind of what a normal American church looks like versus someone who is lukewarm in the New Testament from Revelation and comparing and contrasting. So that's kind of that. We'll unpack it and talk about it next week. That's going to be our intention. Thank you so much for your attention this morning. We'll be dismissed now for about 15 minutes before worship.